trail walking is real. It's really important to remember the trail walking. I saw somebody yesterday with a pit bull, and then somebody else with, what was the other afternoon dog? Oh, it was a Newfie. But the pitty has a tendency to bark and lunge at other dogs and whatnot. And I actually think she's pretty friendly, but she just gets very frustrated and she can't cope. And but what we were talking about is that if you stand still on a trail, you're out of luck. You have to keep moving. Because if you keep moving, the dogs have a moving target, they're going to keep on going and going and going. But if you don't, then it is, it can be very problematic, particularly with certain kinds of dogs, they'll be pretty problematic. That's one of the problems with classes. All the dogs are standing still, so they're all bored. You know, and so then they act out sometimes.
Well, that was going to be, I don't trail walk, so that was going to be my follow-up question. What happens? Well, they get testy, I guess. And do they start snarling at each other?
Well, we're 5 foot whatever, and they're 3 foot whatever, or 2 foot whatever, and so they've got a whole communication stuff going on at a level that we're not even seeing. Mm-hmm. We're not close to that at all, right? And so one of them might be saying nasty things to the other one, and we don't even notice it. And if they are doing that, and they're stable, they're close to each other, then you'll see that what'll happen is it'll be sparked without you even noticing it. So it's one of the reasons why I always say that dogs should never meet for the first time. They should meet for the third time. And so if you're having two dogs meet on a trail, you would have them go past each other, then go past each other and sniff, then go past each other and sniff a little longer. But each time you only have a 3 second hole there for the greeting, so that by the time you're finished with the fourth greeting, they already know each other because they've already smelled each other. They know. This is when you're dealing with problematic dogs, and I see this on the trail that I walk all the time. People go, "Well, my dog is friendly. How come they just had a little confrontation?" And the reason they had a confrontation was because they had a whole conversation going on before we were noticing it, and also. They're meeting for the first time, and that is always tense. Mm-hmm. So right before you came in, I did a evaluation for a dog that's being boarded here, and it's a 6-year-old golden retriever, and the guy was upset because the dog has been underneath his dog walker, and then his daughter or something took the dog to a coffee shop. And would have coffee, and the dog was underneath the table, and they've never thought of the dog as being dog aggressive, but she went after a dog each of those two times, and she didn't actually bite the dog, but she went after the dog, and so what he wanted me to do is come in and resource and figure out what was going on, and she also has some resource guarding, but so I came in and saw the dog and. Who almost took my arm off because she was so agitated. And I brought her in here and she kind of wandered around here for a little bit. And then, but she was panting. Remember all the stuff we were talking about, stress, she was panting, she was stressed. She really wanted to go out. And I evaluated her with my stuffed dog. I did take a video of it. And then I also evaluated her with Aspen. With the stuffed dog, which got really close to her, she started to snarl. And with Aspen, she just completely ignored her as though she didn't even exist. And so I talked to the people here, and I said, does she ever play with dogs? And they said, no. She just ignores them. So her desire to get out of here was so patently, I mean, she's here for a week. So she just really, really wanted to get out. I felt very sorry for her. She's like, I do not want to be here. This is no place I want to be. And so my evaluation is that she, first of all, she'd never go back to daycare again. I mean, unless it's a boarding situation, and then they have to, and then that's fine. But she does not enjoy herself at boarding. She's a 6.5-year-old golden retriever, and she's fat. So she obviously doesn't get a whole lot of exercise at home unless she gets a lot of exercise and a lot of food. and she is wary of other dogs. So what they were seeing was instant territory, like we were talking about before, being still, so being in one spot. So she's fine if they take her on a walk. She doesn't have any problems with the dog at all. But because of all this kind of being still, sitting right there, not knowing what to do, probably being tethered to something, she felt really vulnerable. So I'm going to write back and say, you know, she's a great dog. Stop pushing her in places, putting her in places where she can't handle it.
Mm-hmm. When a dog's coping and turning their head to a corner to make space, I see it as a good thing now if they're still in rescues, you know, like they're a rescue and they're still not adjusted. And I have them in a group because the company assigns me certain dogs that are problems sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I have to put them together, but I separate them and put this dog on tie down, and I see her making space in the corner, and then I praise her. But is that bad?
I don't know that it's bad to do that. I would probably just note it.
Okay.
You know, what you would like her to do eventually is to be able to to make friends in the group.
She's making friends slowly.
Slowly, yeah. So you can just note it, and the other thing about it is probably to honor it, you know, and I'm sure you already do that, so that you don't try to force her into the group if she can't, if she doesn't want to go there and all that kind of stuff.
I let them have their own space.
Yeah, they need their own space.
Take your space.
Yeah, they need their own space.
But okay. This dog can... snap, but not quite fall through, but sound very aggressive.
Yeah, so it's trying to, every time they try to create space by snapping. That's why they
That's how I try to create.
It works, right?
Yeah.
If you get snarky, you bet. If you get snarky, then, and people will leave you alone. So the same thing is true with the dog. If they get snarky, the other dogs will leave them alone. And we say, oh, the dog is being aggressive, and they're being, and we actually think that they're trying to hurt the other dog. But, I mean, honestly, if they wanted to hurt the other dog, they could hurt the other dog. They're really fast.
So I have a question for you then. Then why is it that some dogs are okay with the stillness? You know, like, in this situation, they'd be totally fine being able to self-soothe and just lay down and chill, and some aren't. Is it just innate personality?
Well, that brings us right to this.
Oh, wow.
Because there is constantly this argument, or it's not even an argument. Most people believe that dogs are very malleable. And if you raise them right, they will get right. So they have a tendency to blame people for wrecking dogs. And yet at the same time, we know that, you know, the apple never falls far from the tree. My God, he's just like his father. You know, we understand that with human beings, but we don't get it with dogs.
Mm.
So, yeah.
You know, it's along those lines. A couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine's dog passed, so I started reminiscing and looking at old videos of my dogs and crying. But anyway, I noticed that we got both of our pups when they were 6 weeks old. And when Jeffrey passed away at 9 years, he was that puppy that we got that first day.
Mm-hmm.
It was so much of his personality.
It was there when you got him.
There, he was crotchety old man on day one. and then the other one, when we got in, he is still a sweet, soppy.
Yeah, what you get is, I mean, that's why we, you know, they're about evaluations of puppies. It's always interesting. All the science says that you could evaluate puppies till you're blue in the face, and you're not going to be able to tell whether or not, you know, what they're going to be like when they're adults. And that, to a certain extent, that's true, because puppies have certain things they like to do. They like to play, they like to do this, so, but they are also who they're going to be if you can look for it. And no, there have been no scientifically validated evaluations for this, except for how would you scientifically evaluate it, you know? You have to have the same person doing the same evaluation for each of the puppies, with all the puppies having the same background. They can't just be groups of puppies from rescue and a group of puppies from here and puppies from there and puppies. So you can't validate anything if you have too many different kinds of extraneous pieces going into it. So no, there's not ever going to be an evaluation that actually proves anything whatsoever. There won't be any.
Then how do you do it? Because like your evaluation of Tokoda is so spot on, it kind of blows my mind that you were able to pinpoint all of his.
Well, I can do it. I certainly don't do it 100%. There's no way, but I can do it because I have a lot of experience.
Yeah.
Right, and then there's also looking at the mom and the dad, in which case with your dog, that's what I got to do.
Oh,
so, you know,
yeah.
There was, I already knew the dogs, and then I could know this is a Leonberger. So that was made it easier for me. Also, the dog's bell curve was very shallow. There was nobody who was radically fearful or radically offensive. So they were kind of, most of them were in the middle. I think yours was one of the harder ones. Yeah.
Which is why you got that dog.
So, you know, but we're going to talk about that a little bit because puppies are definitely born. Some of them are much more fearful and cautious than others. It is ethologically appropriate for puppies to be somewhat fearful because if there's no fear, you don't live, you know, in the wild. If you're not afraid of anything, the most... And in fact, that's why at 7 weeks old, they go through this fear period, because as they're going out into the real world, then they need to know to be afraid of things, to avoid things. So, but I saw a puppy this week, and at 7 months, going through a really strong fear imprint period, really, really hefty. And at this point, we have to be very careful to make sure that the dog is okay. Hey. Traffic.
4 miles an hour.
Yeah, sorry about that.
I was in Crestwoods. Woods.
yeah. More than one.
Okay. So puppies can be made fearful by poor socialization. Adolescents can become fearful by just their parentage, but also if they suffer trauma, they can become fearful. Fear, you know, is one of those things that is, it's going to pop up no matter what. And that is actually, in Leonbergers, the most common behavior problem that we have, is fear-based behaviors. And it is with almost all the breeds, I guess. Some much more than others. So I think the Mastiff breeds, like Leonbergers, have a tendency towards it these days. They're trying to breed them so sweet and nice that they probably have gone a little bit overboard.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you work with the dogs or people, we've been talking about emotions, right? And so when you're working with dogs and people, analyze emotional content first if you possibly can. You really want to find out what the dog is feeling and actually what the people are feeling at the same time. I just read a blog by a guy who's does German Shepherd Rescue, and he was interesting because, I mean, he was really good because he was saying, you have to look at both parties. You can't just look at the dog. You have to look at the humans as well. He also had a few things to say about board and train that I entirely agree about. So, oh, you remember the dog, I talked about it, I think, the Great Dane? Did I mention the Great Dane that I was, maybe it was to the last class, she has a dog that's only pushing a year old now, and I've seen the dog since it was a puppy. And he's a nice dog, but he's very mastiffy. He's very kind of forward and pushy. And the woman is really, really nice and sweet. And she has two children, and she's going through a divorce. And so we've got we have a situation here. And so she was very worried about how that puppy was behaving towards the children, which is reasonable. She was the puppy, this is a dog that's this big at 6 months, right? Can go crashing into the kids and knock them down. And also he would take her hand and just kind of move her places and whatnot. So at one point we discussed the idea that maybe she shouldn't even keep him because he was, you know, because she's going through too much and she has a full-time job and everything, you know. She's not hurting for money. She has an au pair and a cleaning woman and a this and a that, you know, so, but she's still got quite a life going. And so I saw her this week and she had sent the dog away for a boarding train. So you know about boarding trains, right? You take the dog to a boarding train for usually 3 to 4 weeks, and they come back knowing, sit, down, come, not really come very well, but heel, sit, down, stay, and usually go to mat or place. And so she brought the dog back, and the dog has now been back for 2 weeks, and the behaviors are eroding already because they're going away. Because they don't stick around. It's a great scam to have, isn't it? Just, you know, I'll take the dog for 3 to 4 weeks to do deprivation training, which is you put the dog in a kennel for 20 hours of every day, and then you work with them for an hour every day, and by golly, that dog will do anything for you because of being deprived. And then within 3 to 4 weeks, all the behaviors start to erode, and then they just go away. And so you go, gosh, it must be me. And they're happy to tell you that, too. Oh, you're just not a very good trainer. I'll have to do it again.
What does that do
How to
their
make
psyche?
Money. What
does it do to their psyche to have them be kennel for?
It's awful. It's terrible. Yeah. It's not an okay thing.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, there have been some times when I've actually recommended board and train, and I have a couple that I go, okay, these are not the worst. But it's only, I had one client who was a 98-year-old woman. She needed board and train. Or she needed somebody to come every day and train the dog. Actually, she needed to get rid of the German Shepherd is what she really needed to do. But I couldn't talk around that, so forget that. That didn't happen. So, yeah, I mean, board and train, the problem with board and train is that the wrong person is telling the dog what to do, the wrong person is teaching the dog what to do, the wrong person has a relationship with the dog, the relationship is built on fear, and it's not going to work. Yeah, you always want to train with clients.
And for them to reinforce
what I'm doing. Right. The very best way to train a dog, and this is actually funny, because this is not what I would normally talk about here, but it comes up, is that what would be really good would be to have classes where everybody works with a trained dog. So the dog is already trained. So they get to learn how to do their hand signals and how to speak with the dog and what to expect. And do that for 3 to 4 weeks before you introduce the new dog, their own dog, into the mix. Because when you're doing classes or when you're doing private training, you are teaching a naive person how to work with an out-of-control animal who doesn't know what is expected of him. So it's the blind leading the blind, and it doesn't work. So if you could do that, that would be the best way to do it. Alternatively, if I were going to go into business now instead of thinking, you know, it's time for me to get out of the business, I would probably have, I would do kind of a form of day training. So I'd say, okay, we need to work once a week, me and the client, and I want to work with a dog twice a week or maybe three times a week. So that would make, you know, I'll work with a dog one day and then I'm going to work with you and the dog the next day or the next time. And then I'm going to work with the dog and then I'm going to work with you and the dog. And the reason I would do that is so that I could start instilling the behaviors that I wanted to instill in the dog and then work with the person at the same time, you know, so that the dog will already know a little bit. So it's a little bit opposite of what I was talking about before, but it's probably the way that would be a good way to do it. Day trainers do that to a certain extent, but it's hard. Okay, so if you don't address emotions, then behavior modification won't work, which I guess plays into that whole thing of the board and train, right? Because you're not working with emotions in board and train. You are now working with the behaviors, with the outward manifestation of what you want the dog to do. Yeah? So you're not working through love. You're not working because you hate the dog. The dog is just learning sit means sit, down means down, all that kind of stuff. But if the dog is fearful, for instance, and even though all these behaviors have been, they call it installed, I say instilled, I think it's nicer, then the behaviors won't hold. if that makes any sense. Okay, so it's important to remember that dogs respond differently from one another when they are stressed. This is actually is really important. We know this theoretically, but it's difficult to bring it to mind when we have a very scared animal to deal with. So this is a particular dog that is going from one kind of stress to another. Shall I get the, I'll get the light. So just, do some music. This is at Marin Humane Society, a little dog that came in. And it's such a good video of a dog being in conflict, going back and forth. I don't think I played this for you, did I? Okay. So just watch all the emotions go through this dog's face. So, tell me what you saw. No, the dog could not take treats because he was too stressed. So what kind of stress signals did you see? What expressions on his face did you see which would cause you to think that he was either fearful, conflicted, or becoming friendly?
The pursed mouth.
Pardon?
The pursed mouth.
Pursed mouth, right. And he actually was showing his teeth at one. Did he look like he was aggressive when he was doing that?
No.
He was very fearful, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So when he actually was even growling, I don't know if you could hear him growling, he was backing up and growling at the same time. So he was doing that. He definitely, his eyes were very rounded and his eye pupils were dilated. Did you see him do a genital check a couple of times? Just to make sure everything's okay back there? Yeah.
He did lots of little tongue
flicks. Lots and lots of tongue flicks. His ears were kind of pinned back but curled. His hackles were up the whole time, right? They did come down just a little bit, then they came right back up again. And what else? Yeah.
Well, when he started to wag his tail towards the end, I noticed it was like wagging, but only with the bottom half. Yeah.
Right,
tail.
a very submissive wag.
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Yeah, that was a very submissive wag.
I thought it was so interesting. I don't know if it was you or someone else who yelled at him.
I did.
Yeah. the reaction that you got compared to when the other person was?
It was me. All of that was me. Yeah, I was actually doing that for the video. I wanted to show what happened when you talk in a different way to a dog. That if they start to show their teeth like that, then if you yell at them, that's going to get worse. So you could actually see him really go from something like a defensive to almost being offensive when I yelled at him, and then he went back again. Did you notice that he actually did a submissive grin then? So when his eyes kind of changed their focus when he did that, and he acted a little bit more comfortable.
Did you change your body language when you started speaking in a more gentle tone?
Yes, my voice made a huge difference. Also, I squatted. You couldn't see it, but I started by standing up fairly tall, and I ended up dropping way down and kind of sitting on the run. And then he could come up to me, and that's when he did that. And you couldn't see me, but I was actually turning my head slightly away. And that's when he said, I can come all the way up here. So you got a whole, remember I said you got to look at the emotions of both the species here? And this is really important, because what I was doing was, it certainly patently had an effect on him, and what he was doing had an effect on us. So he was actually communicating, right? I mean, does he want to be communicating? Yes, I think he does. You know, I think that people say that dogs just do what they do and they're not trying to tell you something, but I think they actually are trying to tell you. In his case, back off. Please don't come any closer. I'm really too afraid. Now, the stress signals he gave, the things like the genital check and his eyes rounding out and all that, those are not necessarily intentionally communicative. They're a response to the emotion. But a lot of the others were intentionally communicative. Anybody ever heard of calming signals? Turtid Rugas with calming signals? So she goes through an awful lot of these same signals and calls them calming signals because they are aimed at calming the other dog. And I love Turtid Rugas. She's wonderful, and I completely disagree with her on this. I think that an awful lot of these vocalizations and the expressions on the dog's face are involuntary. They're not aimed at calming anybody else down or whatever. However, there are some, I think, that are. So if a dog does a genital check, it's not trying to tell another dog anything. If he drops down and he's really scared, he is trying to tell a dog something. I'm not a threat. So I think some of them are and some of them aren't. Yawning, Turid thinks of as a communicative signal, and I do not. I see dogs yawn whether there's another dog in the room or another human in the room or not. So the yawning is just an effort by the body to get more oxygen into the system to get it prepared for flight, right? So even though yawning can be taken as a stress signal by us, when we look at a dog and we see a yawning dog, we go, okay, he's probably stressed. That isn't necessarily the case from the point of view of the dog actually trying to tell you that. Yeah?
How about like a shake-off?
When they shake themselves off? Yeah, I don't think that's communicative. However, something I do think is communicative is if a dog is coming towards, one dog is coming towards another dog and the dog does this whole thing where they look away, I think they're literally telling the other dog, don't come any closer, I don't want you to be too close to me. So I actually think, and it's really an interesting thing because guess what, you get to decide for yourself whether you think dogs are communicating something or whether they're doing an involuntary expression. That, because there is no scientific validity to all the ethologists do is market. They all say, this is what happens when a dog is stressed. But whether or not it's communicative, that has not been, there's been no definitive proof, and I don't know that there ever will be because we're talking about behavior here. And I love a quote that I occasionally use as part of my signature, which is, you know, you can set up your experiment with all the appropriate parameters and everything in it, and the dog will do what it damn well pleases. Because they're sentient beings, and they get to decide on their own what they're going to do. So this is just a fun exercise, but I'm going to replay the video again. And in this case, try to think of what the when the dog is trying to tell me something, or when the dog is just having a response to stress. Okay, you don't have to mark it down or anything, but if you can remember it, that would be really good. This is actually one of my favorite videos, and it's very old. And I'm going to do this.
Telling me something?
Yes.
So you saw the time flick there?
Yeah.
You think that was telling me something? Telling me something here?
Yes.
Yeah, it's all the way tucked under. All the way tucked under. He's very afraid. But can you see he's coming forward a little bit? Now I'm yelling at him. And you can see the eyes change completely. Big yell. And so he's showing his gums. If I went too close at that point, he would definitely bite me. That's a genital check. You think that's telling me anything? No, it's not, right? And here I'm being nicer. And you can see I'm kind of shifting my body posture a little bit, which makes him think he can come closer. And now a lot of communication.
Yeah, eyes are soft.
But way, way too stressed to eat anything.
Yeah.
Susan, are we going to go out? Another check? Do you think he's going to be a nice guy for somebody?
I think that
once he gets out of this horrible jail cell and gets to be in a home, he's probably going to be fine.
What was his story? Do you know?
I don't know. We'd get all kinds of dogs in strays that you don't know where they came from or how they got there, unless you were in the animal control division, and then you would. But other than that.
Can they also communicate on confused? This is called,
I call it conflicted.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's the same thing, it's confused. And I have a good friend who always used to say, because when we would talk about doing evaluations, just assume confusion. You know, many of my clients say things like, oh, we decided to go to the bathroom on the bed. Let's just assume confusion, shall we? He didn't actually do it to be a jerk. You know, assume that he's confused, he doesn't know what's happening, and that's why he's doing stuff. Make sense? Okay, so we're just going to touch on this a little bit. Modifying the behavior of fearful dogs. Fear is not under the control of the conscious brain. Fear is under the control of the subconscious or the hindbrain, the amygdala. So you can't kind of talk a fearful dog out of being fearful. You have to actually show them that whatever it is that they were afraid of, they should not be afraid of. And you have to make them feel safe. And the best way that we know how to do that at the moment is to, first of all, put them in a safe place. Don't stick them underneath a table, you know, at a coffee shop if they can't handle it. And then the second thing is to take on the role of leader. And this isn't to say you take on a role of an alpha. This is not the same thing. This is just the role of a caretaker, of a parent who is going to keep their child safe or their dog safe. And that's what that's really all about. So we get more into more of that. Well, actually, we might get a little bit more into that in the next couple of weeks, but it also comes under, it's a shorter module. Okay, so stress plus space invasion. Creates a situation where the dog has to make a decision as to whether they can run away, whether they should run away or fight. So if you have a dog that is not stressed and you intrude upon their space, they're probably going to be okay. But if the dog is stressed and you intrude upon their space, so take dogs in a shelter or some dogs in a daycare if they're first going into the daycare or whatever. So if those two things happen, if you have stress plus space invasion, you're asking for trouble. So when I go to people's homes, and I know that then most of the time I've got stressed dogs in each of the homes, I'm going to probably not invade their space even the tiniest little bit until they start invading my space. And I'm not stressed particularly. Depends on the dog. Sometimes I'm very stressed. But most of the time I'm just sitting there, and when they start kind of approaching me, then I'll approach them. So I need to make sure their stress level drops. And I've seen a lot of new consultants and new trainers trying to impress their clients with how great they are with dogs, really try to make friends before the dog is ready to make friends. And you see this in training classes all the time. And the reason you see it in training classes is because when you have 10 or 12 dogs and their people in class, you can't pay enough attention to know exactly who's stressed. And some dogs behave in a far more stressed way than others do. So, I mean, some of them have actually, they hide all their symptoms. They look fine, but they're not fine. They just are still. So you have to be very aware of that kind of thing. Oh, that's a cute little dog. Okay, so this is something that I've made. The active defense reflex. Okay, we haven't talked about that, right? So when a dog feels anxiety, so feels stressed, okay, so up here is stress. Then they have a choice. They go from stress to anxiety avoidance. So anxiety avoidance essentially means I'm really worried about something, I'm going to try to get out of the way. And active defense reflex and passive defense reflex. So that's one kind of dog. An active defense reflex dog is a kind of dog who will go towards a threat, right? Somebody who has a high fight instinct. And a passive defense reflex is a dog that will choose flight. Generally, they don't necessarily choose flight as in running away. Flight might take the form of avoidance, of starting to chew on themselves, doing self kind of destruction things or whatever. There's a lot of different things that a PDR dog can do to try to avoid stress. They all will do a freeze. So if I'm worried, if there's something happening, I'm going to freeze, and then I'm going to choose what I'm going to do after that freeze. So you'll have a tiny little freeze or a very long freeze, depending on the dog. So that dog that we saw, that little Minpin, did you see the little tiny freezes in there? You know, so those are all, I think of them as being decision makers. That's when the dog is deciding, what am I going to do next? What am I going to do next? So if you take advantage of those, you can actually help the dog make proper decisions for that. So you got, the dog is, this is your active defense reflex dog, your ADR dog. This is your passive defense reflex. They'll both freeze, and then they have to decide whether or not they want to do fight, flight, or tend, befriend. And tend, befriend essentially means try to diffuse the whole thing, make sure everybody's okay and all that stuff. And my German Shepherd, Strider, used to do that. If he felt stressed at all, he'd start doing play bows. Anybody ever seen a dog do that? It's really cute.
My dog does that. It's hilarious.
Yeah, and it's like going.
Woo! And then he takes off.
It's like being a comedian.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to make you laugh. You're going to be very happy now. So it's really trying to diffuse the problem. It works. It totally works. And in fact, you can do it yourself if your dog is, particularly if you have a dog that you have a good relationship with and they're getting stressed and you start, and you don't buy into the stress. You don't go, it's all right, it's okay, everything, you know, you don't do that and you don't get mad. Instead, you start going, let's go play a game. Let's go do that. That's the same thing as tend, befriend. Some dogs do it naturally. Some people do it naturally. Sometimes we have to actually force ourselves to do it. But it's almost always a good choice.
So I have a question about the tend to befriend. I was doing a puppy social scene, and there was one dog that was splitting two dogs that were, their threshold was they were just reaching that high arousal, and so there was one dog that kept splitting the two of them. Is that more?
That's not really, that actually is its own thing. It is like the herding dogs particularly will try to do, to split to diffuse attention. Mm-hmm. It probably is a form of tend to befriend, except it's usually pretty serious. They're not actually, there's no sense of humor about it, right? They're just kind of like, no, you guys, you've got too much energy going here. I've got to stop you from doing it. She does it by barking, which of course makes everything worse.
That's right, that barks.
Yeah. But a lot of dogs will do it. They'll just get in the middle and try to push one dog one way and the other dog the other way. And it is, I've heard it described as being something that the dog becomes uncomfortable with the amount of energy. And so what they try to do is diffuse the energy by splitting up what's going on. And you can also see these dogs do this when people hug. People are getting too close. They're getting, and the dog comes in the middle and tries to push him. Now, it can be jealousy, but it also can be the energy level is too high here, and I want to reduce it, and so I need to make more space between you guys.
Is there a possibility that the dog would be defending their person?
Yes, that certainly is it. But if it's, I mean, in the case of our Australian Shepherd, Dee Dee used to do it every time we hugged. Uh-huh. And she liked both of us. So she wasn't trying to defend anybody. She just didn't like, we were too close. She says, you know, I know the sheep are all supposed to be this far away from one another. And, you know, you guys are just getting too close here. So it was a problem that, you know.
So are they experiencing like a sense of anxiety?
It's a sense of anxiety. But it's also, you remember seeing the video of the dogs, the herding dogs doing their job? So you can see how strong that tendency to actually control things is. Mm-hmm. That's why we call them bossy ossies. Mm-hmm. And healers are the worst, you know, because healers actually will get in there and nail you in order to stop you from being too close to something. And I like healers, but I would have a healer, except for they bark. Their bark is worse than that one's. So. But, you know, space problems are we're always going to have an issue with that because human beings don't do anything like respect the space needs of dogs. The dominant species never respect space needs of the subordinate species. And this also is like the dominant sex does not respect the space needs of the subordinate sex. Or the dominant race, or the dominant anything, they don't respect what the other entity needs, and it's you know, we should not be surprised if people get bitten, because that's kind of what happens, or nailed in some other way. Okay, so this is a video. This is actually a really interesting video about space. This is a healer, and this is one of my two stuffed dogs, and so you just get to watch. What he does.
So this is a black dog. You saw a tongue flick there, tongue mm-hmm. flick. Ears are back. Very, very stiff. Look how tall he is.
It's not
going
to work
as much. Heels up. Heels up. He looks in the eye. Gets all pissed off. Good dog. Then the woman feeds him like that. He does. I'll go again. This is now a blonde dog.
She's going, I'm smart now.
Duffy.
And look at the difference.
Now look, tails down.
There's still some
much,
stress.
Much better. Much,
but
much better.
Compared to the black dog, we had a lot of stress.
I think that's a function of the physical body. The other dog is a black dog. Keep it going. Keep watching. I don't know. See how nervous the dog is with the black dog?
Look how tough
it is.
Look. It's just fascinating.
Isn't that amazing? Very nervous. So this is another thing too. Like, yeah.
It could be
really good. Well, because that dog, what's happening?
Look at that stressy on. Here comes the black dog, looking away, tongue flick.
Yeah.
Tense, look how tense his little feet are and the legs are. Look at the tail right here.
Yeah.
Right at the base of the tail is coming up. This dog is really tense. And here comes the start of the other one. Ah, feel better now. This is just a stuffed dog, I don't care.
What's the difference?
Well, we can talk about it because there's a variety of things here. This is one of them. There it goes again. Okay, so isn't that interesting? I love that video as well. So that dog is there was a couple of studies. I think neither one of them were all that great, but you know, that's the way it goes. The
about black dogs with drop ears and no tail and dog parts compared to normal dogs. And what they found was the black dog with like Rotties got into way more fights. Dobies got into way more fights at dog parks. So the fact of the matter is the dog is black. So it's harder to read their expression. In the case of the Dobie, the prick ears look like they're in a state of arousal. And so there's a kind of a part of it is a black thing, but part of it is also where the ears are and the tail is and the softness of the eyes. So you can really see that it's the visual that causes the dog to respond to it. You could say that it has something to do with scent, but it doesn't, does it? Because these dogs don't smell like anything. Well, they smell like a whole bunch of other dogs. But to me, it's really fascinating to show the difference in the way the dogs respond to one stuffed dog compared to another stuffed dog, with a real, real dramatic difference in the behaviors of the dog. Yeah?
Well, in the black one, the kind of much more alert, kind of chest forward.
His teeth pulled forward.
Yeah. And then when the blonde one went down, it sort of naturally slumped into this lower position as related to...
Yeah, that's why if you really wanted to do it, you would have two dogs that look the same but were different colors. Mm-hmm. And you would have two dogs that were the same color but had different postures. So, but I wasn't trying to do that. So, you know, and I'm not sure that the owner would have been all that interested in participating anyway. And you'd need to do it over and over and over again to really find a true... But you can see, if you go walking around dog park and you look at the different dogs that are in the dog park, when they first start their meeting another dog, they're going to have a really different response, not only with the other dog's body language, but also the way the dog looks. And we know this to be true because we know that some dogs really don't like German Shepherds and some dogs really don't like Golden Retrievers and some dogs really, you know, they get their prejudices usually based on some past experience. And so they're making this decision right away of whether or not they think another dog is a threat. So we know that part is true. What we don't know are the nuances of, was it because the black dog has direct eye contact and the blonde dog, because of the ways the eyes are made, has less blind contact. Now, you know, I've been using these stuffed dogs in evaluations and whatnot for the last 20 years, 30 years, whatever it's been. And in the beginning, when I started doing it, people didn't believe anything. They were like, oh, the dogs know it's a stuffed dog. So nobody believed me. I even did a talk on it at APDT. The people thought it was really fascinating, but they didn't. And now everybody uses them, by the way. So I guess I got vindicated. But then, at that point, I didn't, you know, nobody else was using them. And... So one of my friends she worked for the ASPCA, and they had a bust, I think it was like 122 pit bulls. And they had to figure out what to do with these pitties. You know, how many needed to be euthanized because they were too aggressive, how many could be sent to, fosters, how many could be sent to rescues, how many could be adopted. And they had to do all this fairly quickly. So particularly the triage part of it, you know, like, is this dog too aggressive to even start being put through a process? So what she did is she had a golden retriever. She got one of the big golden retrievers, and she tested each one of the dogs with the golden retrievers. But because she's a scientist, she wanted to see if she could get any more information. So there were a good percentage of the dogs that did not respond to the golden retriever. And most of them, not all, but most of them ended up being very social. So they were fine. What I think they were probably doing is allowing themselves time to think before they met the dog. That's probably, you know, kind of just a little bit more front brain dogs. Another grouping actually would attack the dogs, and then when you lifted the dog up, then they'd go, oh my God, this is a stuffed dog, I'm okay. And those dogs were kind of on the cusp. They were a little bit harder to deal with, but the dogs that actually took the dogs down, they had to replace this thing a whole bunch of times. They'd take the dog down, they start doing a kill bite, which is the bite in the back of the neck. And they couldn't get them out of their mouth. Those dogs actually ended up being truly aggressive. And they did, the reason they knew they were truly aggressive is because then they did a follow-up test with muzzles on those dogs to make sure that they had the right dogs. And they found that it was predictive, not 100% predictive, but predictive of the future behavior of the dogs. It's really quite interesting. So I still use them and used it today. You know, I didn't want to have Aspen have to deal with that golden retriever if the golden was going to bite him, right? I wanted to have another dog do it. So I used a dog that doesn't have very much of a very high pain threshold. Yeah. Can you talk louder? I can't hear you.
I don't know if you remember, but one of my girlfriend's coworkers was with you when he used to stuff the animal with the dog being older, and he could only be in his yard. He wasn't allowed to walk outside. He was completely unsocialized, and the family was about to have a baby. And my girlfriend's name was Bridget, but she said that he used to stuff the animal to see how he'd react. And we thought, she had gotten bitten by a boulder by accident when another dog approached. So we kind of thought, like, even despite the training or the consultation, that maybe they would have rehomed him or sent him back.
Did they?
I don't know. I was just wondering if you remember.
No. Okay. Unfortunately, the ones I remember are the ones I have video of, so I look at them again and again.
We felt so bad for him.
Pardon?
We felt so bad for him because he didn't know how to act.
I remember a dog named Boulder, but I can't remember any of the specifics of it.
He was huge and black.
Yeah.
And he just had a rough time. So.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that it's so hard because you really love these dogs and sometimes they are not good for a family or whatever. It can be really difficult. Okay.
Well, she was amazed by your book, by
the way. Oh, well, that was nice. Okay, so this is a fun one. This is actually at Wolf Park. This is, so my daughter and I are sitting towards the front there. And this is the one of the dominant bulls in the pack, and this is a youngster right here, and I can't remember her name, but you can see that there's some space taking here. Looks nasty, doesn't it? And then you can see the puppy is kind of going, "Ah, oh, really, Dad? Honest." That's the photographer. They said, they go, "Oh yeah, we've all been bitten." You know, by these wolves. The little female there became the pack leader. And then was subsequently...
Was she the one that was pushed out?
Huh?
Was she the one that you were saying got pushed out?
Was she one the what?
The one that got pushed out.
Yeah, that was her.
Wait, who is this?
Huh? Indiana. Yeah, it's great. Go there. It's near Tufts University, I think. Oh no, not Tufts. Oh God, I can't remember. But anyway, yeah, it's great to go. They have seminars all the time. You just look up Wolf Park. They have seminars, and you can go there for a weekend seminar. You can just go there to visit. Yeah, it's lovely. Robin, my daughter and I both went, and we really enjoyed ourselves. And the wolves are fascinating. They also have several other animals there, coyotes and foxes and whatnot. But it was started by a professor, a scientist named Eric Klinghammer, and he has since passed away. But his work has been seminal to wolves, and he's really a cool guy. These are wolves in captivity. They're in very large enclosures. They cannot necessarily have all the wolves in the same enclosure because sometimes they don't get along with one another. Mm-hmm. But they allow them to live pretty much as they would live. So you don't always see them because the enclosures are very large. But and they bring in roadkill for them to kill and whatnot. But they're it's an interesting process. They take the puppies away from the mom, I think when they're like 2 weeks old, and raise them until they're 8 weeks old or 7 weeks old with human beings so that they will accept human beings. And then they put them back in, and everything else is, you know, they don't ever teach them anything. Mm-hmm. Although they do husbandry work with them. So if they get something that they need to get, that they teach them to put out their paw to get a shot or something mm-hmm. like that. So they do teach that kind of stuff. But as far as I know, it's still going, even though Dr. Klinghammer died. And some of the people who do it are really interesting. So let me see. I wanted to actually, this is too close, obviously. So this dog belonged to an officer at the Marine Humane Society, and she gave me these pictures. This is another dog is coming close. Can you see this dog is kind of going back off?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then this one now is like really, really too close. Really, really, really too close. And then this is the video. Again, these are all proximity videos, what you do if you get too close to an animal, which can be. So this one, have you seen this video? It's an old video from YouTube, but it's very startling. Told you it was startling. So I want you to watch what happens here because it's really important, and every person in the world needs to see what happens when you go over a dog's head and do direct eye contact at the same time. And it's not obviously every dog, but this dog, this video was taken at a school. This trainer, the police officer, was taking the dog to the school to show the children how wonderful these dogs are. And so this guy is a reporter and obviously relatively clueless. And I think if you look at the expression on the police officer's face, he also is relatively clueless.
Oh, just even
so look,
there.
Yeah, right down, okay? So the dog is already saying, no, you can't do that. Just amazing. The other thing that's very important here is to realize this is not a real bite. This is called a disciplinary bite. This bite actually left little tiny holes on his face here. No, little tiny holes. And he was very funny. He put, you know, Band-Aids on each of these. And then he did his stand-up. I mean, he went on to do his stand-up report. So he was obviously not badly hurt. You know what this dog could have done to him?
Oh, yeah.
He could have just kind of ripped his face off. But instead he said, no, back off, buddy. And it's exactly what a wolf would do with another wolf or a dog will do with another dog. So that's called a disciplinary bite. And we see these things all the time, these disciplinary bites. Where a child goes too close to a dog and the dog goes like this and just gets, you know, just a little bite. And people always go, oh, I almost got bitten. Nah, you didn't almost got bitten. The dog didn't mean to bite you. That was why you had this little tiny bite. But this is a disciplinary bite right here.
Do they usually or sometimes or always break skin?
No. Nope. So it can be an air bite, which is that first one, like, you know, back off. It can be a open mouth bite like that, which hurt because of the teeth hitting you, but they don't leave any kind of bite, or they can actually close just a little bit on the skin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've been wondering about this for a couple of years, and I think this might be what she's doing, but a friend of mine has a Catahoula, and there's this routine that they do, and every time they had a party, but every time a new person enters the house, the Catahoula, you have to stand there, you can't just go into the door, you have to stand there, she has to check you out first, and then you get the okay to go in the door.
She's the doorman, or sorry, right, the door dog.
Security, right, so they were having a party, and this one guy, so my friend goes, this one guy is like, I'm not doing that, and he just blew past the Catahoula, and she gave him a little boop on the butt. On the bum, she gave him a little nip. And I wonder, was that a disciplinary nip?
It probably was. It's kind of the don't let the door hit you on the way out bite. But and we do see this a lot. But yes, if he did, if he just blew right past her, then she probably was saying, "Hey, back off, buddy. I need you to come back over here so I can check you out." Yeah, I need to be able to check you out here. And Catahoulas are amongst the groupings of dogs that are definitely protective. Mm-hmm. I saw a Catahoula, I guess it was this past week, with somebody with two children. The dog is 4 years old. Actually, this is a really good example of people pushing a dog past where they could, where they comfortably can go. Did I tell you this already? They were, I never can remember when I went to see people and all that, but they're really very, very nice folks. The dog has never given them any problem. They have two small children. The dog has been growling at the little boy for about a year, which means the dog is really patient. And so they have more or less just not paid any attention to it. They had the dog, they had a trainer come in who was a very compulsive trainer. And so they taught the dog to go to place and a few other things, but she didn't talk to them at all about the possibility that he might do something naughty, you know, that the dog might do something naughty. Anyway, so they went to Clear Lake. They have a house in Clear Lake, and then they have a house in Novato, in the very ritziest area of Novato, and they're probably in their early 30s, and I'm like, how did you get this much money? Anyway, when they went to Clear Lake, they were there with 8 children, and they were there for a long weekend. So Friday and Saturday, the dog was fine, and on Sunday she bit 4 kids. Not badly, but they were all disciplinary bites. All of them were disciplinary bites. But then the next morning, on Monday morning, they were back home, and she bit, or he, I can't remember, bit the little boy. Again, not badly, it was, I mean, just a little tiny scrape. But now they're worried if they're, you know, do they have an aggressive dog? So we talked a lot about the fact that, you know, your dog ran out of self-control. That at some point, the dog could not handle the amount of stress that the dog was under with 8 children in, you know, running all over the place in Clear Lake for 3 days, and probably was trying to tell the kids to back off and give him some space. And the same thing was true the next morning. So great people, wonderful people. We did talk about where, you know, where the dog was likely to growl at the child at what time of the day, and it turns out it's 0 hour. You know, it's that when kids get all difficult to deal with somewhere between 5 and 7 in the evening usually, and dogs, young dogs often get the same way. So what they're going to do is they're going to put the dog in another room and give him a bone every evening from 4 to 6 or whatever the time is for them, so that everybody can have chill time. And I think that's going to work just fine. But it is interesting because at that point, when kids get into his space, he can't handle it. But at other times, he has no problem with it. So that the time of day things happen, and whether or not other things have been happening and how much has been stacking is called trigger stacking. But how much has been going on through the day might cause a problem like that.
Can dogs do this with puppies too?
Oh God, yes, absolutely.
So when they connect on a puppy, it's not intentional, or I guess.
It's intentional. It's not serious.
Yes.
I mean, it's very much like, you know, it's almost in a lot of ways it's considered. It's like you're out of line. Mm-hmm. Remember, I showed the video of our hound.
Yeah.
With the puppy,
yeah.
And she, you know, that she had no intention of hurting that puppy, right? She's just like, nah, nah, and the puppy rolls away. Oh my God, that was a close call. You know, so that's exactly the same thing that she did, that this dog did with the children.
So, as an owner, is there like that? The Catahoula parents, for example, they could have been watching for the triggers in that dog.
Yeah, well, if they had actually been watching the dog instead of watching the kids, which people don't do, you know, they watch the kids, they want to make sure the kids don't drown and all that kind of stuff. So what the best thing to do is usually to, if you're thinking, you go, okay, how unusual is this circumstance for the dog? How much do I think he may or may not be able to handle it? And what can I do to make sure problems don't occur?
Yeah.
You know, but that would be something that you or I might do. it is not necessarily something a normal person would do. Because normal people, what we think of as normal people, not people who spend Sunday afternoon sitting in a group, you know, what normal people think is that dogs are supposed to do what we want them to. And what nobody's telling them is that dogs do what they do. And sometimes it's things that you care, you know, you want them to, and sometimes it's not things that you want them to, but so it is. Okay, so puppies see other dogs as puppies and behave as they would to their sibling. And that's very different from adults. Adult dogs see other dogs as interesting, challenging, or threatening. And what is an adult? An adult is a dog that has grown up. And in some cases, if it's a small dog, that dog might be a year to a year and a half. If it's a large dog, it might be 4 or 5. Right? It depends on the dog's mental age, as well as the size of the dog and the breed of the dog and all that kind of stuff. But here's where human beings get caught. We get caught thinking, not all of us, but other people get caught thinking that dogs are puppies for all of their lives. Because you get a dog when it's a puppy and you assume that dog is the puppy forever. Because you care for it as though you would a puppy. And because it's a prisoner in your home as it would be, you know, as an adult dog. So people who think, well, I'm, you know, my dog is has the same needs. I've had people who actually don't give the dog the run of the house when they're 4 years old because the dog chews. And I say, when was the last time the dog chewed? Well, when it was a year old. Okay, so it's had a lot of time to grow out of chewing. And the chances are it has grown out of chewing. So let's try this again. I do not like the idea of leaving a dog in a crate for all of its life. It doesn't compute with me. So, you know, if you still have proof that the dog is still chewing, then for sure, you know, you're going to probably need to have it in a crate, at least for a while longer. But, you know, they grow up and they grow out of things. And some, as they grow up and they grow out of things, they stop chewing, they stop digging to a certain extent. Depends on the breed. They stop acting like every other person is their friend or every other dog is their friend. So a puppy tends to think of dogs as other puppies. It thinks of people as puppies. It thinks of people as chew toys, you know. But as an adult dog, they do not. They start thinking of other dogs as being interesting. Oh, I'm going to go up. You know, most dogs get interested in other dogs. Or challenging, especially if the dog has had an issue of some kind, or threatening, you know. So they also try to read us as though we were dogs, you know. I have these clients who say things like, "Oh, my dog thinks it's a person." Really? You think so? You think he thinks that he can do things with his hands, like open up refrigerators and open up cans and get things out? You really think he thinks you're a dog. He thinks you're a magic dog, if he's going to think anything of the sort. I think what they think of probably is that we're gods and this is cool. You know, we can do things like open car doors and let them in. You know, these are things that we can do. In fact, we can magically transport them from one place to another where there's all these cool things that happen. So, you know, they know they're not dogs, but they read us as though we are dogs because that's all they can do. And so we have to remember that as the dominant species, we should be the ones knowing, you know, allowing ourselves to be read and try to read them back again. And here's where we have a big issue with people and dogs. So we're linear. We are a linear species, relatively linear species. That means when I go to meet you, I go, "Hi, how are you?" Right, like this, right? We're linear. We're going straight across. We extend our hand for greeting because that's what we do. In fact, when you do this, you're oftentimes what you're doing is actually intentionally increasing the space between the two of you. I want this much space between you and me, and this is a good way to do this. And many cultures do this. Not all cultures, but many of them do. We do direct eye contact. Again, this is our culture. Many other cultures do not do any direct eye contact. Or if they do, it's always seen as a threat or challenging. But in our particular culture, we have a tendency to be very straightforward, to do direct eye contact. Everything about us is linear. We have sidewalks, you walk on sidewalks. We do, you know, that's who we are. But that's not who dogs are. Dogs are nonlinear. They're circuitous. They zigzag. How many of you guys have ever walked your dog and gone, my God, back and forth and back and forth? And why do they zigzag? They're picking up scents. They're picking up with their nose in the air because of the way the wind wafts back and forth, and they pick up scents on either side of a pathway. So they're going to get as much information as they possibly can. Yeah?
I'm trying to remember the name of this book, but I think it was called, I don't know, it doesn't matter what it was called, but Science Friday is my favorite show. She was talking about how dogs are starting to lose their sense of smell because we don't let them smell.
Well, it's quite possible because it's not used. They're not used. If you don't use something, it goes away.
Yeah.
And that's what happened to our noses.
Exactly.
We don't use them.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at gorillas and the other hominids, they all use their noses much, much more than we use our nose. So yeah, I imagine that's probably true. But why they do that, they're doing that for a couple of reasons. Now, if a dog catches a scent of something that's interesting, they go from being circuitous to being straight on. You know, they're going to go after that squirrel. They're going to go after whatever. And so as soon as they catch the scent, they're going to change it. But their normal way of walking is kind of in a, this way. And, of course, that's why we get all pissed off, because we want them to heal, because we're the dominant species and they're supposed to heal right next to us. And I always think it's funny because people go, well, you know, isn't he supposed to do that? I don't know if you ask him, no. he doesn't think he's supposed to heal. He thinks he's supposed to investigate stuff. So when I walk, usually I walk off leash because I want them to be able to investigate and use their noses and use what they should be using.
Trying to tell me what to do before you can tell the puppy what to do. You're supposed to walk them in zigzags so that they follow your direction before they decide where they want to go.
So they're trying to take advantage. This is a puppy class, did you say?
It was my boss.
So what they're trying to do is take advantage of the fact that dogs don't walk in a direct line and teach the dog to follow the human?
Yeah.
That's probably a fairly good idea. I don't necessarily do zigzags, but I teach dogs to follow me as opposed to putting them on leash. I don't teach dogs, puppies, to walk on leash until after I've taught them to walk with me.
Mm-hmm.
So because they have to learn to follow me before I put them on leash. And the reason is because they'll use the leash to go where they want to go, and then I'm going to end up pulling it. So if you've got a puppy, is that what you did with your?
Yeah. I did that with Jack and Dakota, and they both now, Dakota's so big, but neither one of them pull because the draw is to stay with me.
They want to be near you.
Yeah.
So that's how we teach all of our dogs to do. Yeah. So if you have the luxury of having puppies, if you don't have if you've gotten a rescue dog, forget it.
Right.
You're not going to be able to teach that. Well, you can. There are a variety of ways that you can actually help a dog learn that to follow you. But again, what we're talking about now is natural body language, and the natural body language of a dog is going to be a lot looser than our natural inclination to. And in fact, that's something that we learn if you think about it. If you go for anybody here had kids? If you go for a walk with a kid, it's very frustrating because you want to go somewhere and the kid's going. You know, because they're exploring, they're testing. And so what we learn over a period of time, and in fact you can watch, if you watch people walking kindergartners or the little kids, and they're holding like this, come on, keep going, kids, keep, because the kids want to go wandering off into other areas, and that, of course, is what dogs want to do as well. The problem is that direct line behavior from the point of view of a dog, you can end up with behavior problems if you insist that they do what you do and walk in a straight line. Because if you think about it, if there's somebody walking this way in a straight line and somebody else walking this way, and the dog's natural inclination is going to be to be circuitous, to actually go around so that they can diffuse any kind of potential issues, which is one of the things that they're doing, then you are interfering with their body language. And man, is it difficult to talk to people about this. Because you know, I have one of my... one of the people I see on a path all the time, they go, well, how come my dog goes in this big arc around other dogs? This dog happens to be off leash. And I said, he doesn't want to meet the other dogs. And she said, well, why not? And I said, you know, I don't know. But, you know, but the fact is that that Finn arcs around other dogs. He does not have any desire to meet other dogs. He has lots of other things on his mind. Most of them start off with the word B, or the letter B, and end up with LL. So that's what he wants to do. He does not want to do anything else. So he arcs around, which is what dogs do to avoid other dogs, which is what people do to avoid other people. I mean, that's what we do as well. We arc around. The problem is if you're on a sidewalk, you can't arc very well. And so it's incumbent upon you to get in places where you have a little bit more room. If you have a dog that's got any fear issues or any kind of issues at all that might, you know, that might indicate that he would need that. So the more confident a dog is, the less they arc. So you got a really, really confident dog who's going up to meet another dog, they're gonna just kind of go straight up. Hello, here I am. A less confident dog is probably gonna do these little arcs around, make sure everything's okay. And the more confident dogs will move faster, less confident dogs will move more slowly as they are trying to decide what to do. So if I had a not very confident dog and he started to slow down when I was coming pet to another dog or to a person and he seemed to want to move out of the way, my inclination is going to be to respect his desires, respect his wishes, and to move a little bit around the way. That is not the case with the vast majority of other people. They don't want to do that. They want to teach the dog to walk right past another dog and to be good walking right past another dog. So, but it, I think it's important. If you look at this photo, this is Strider meeting another dog, and look at the body language, how arced they both are, right? And I think, probably gonna go to some video of that. Yeah, so, in a minute. Okay, so anyway, before we get into, we're gonna do some play video, popping up here in a second. But if everything goes well in puppyhood, the mom dog has taught puppies bite inhibition with the use of consequences, which we saw in our videos last week. Puppies are really curious. They need to be persistent in order to survive, and they need to play to learn.